Today is Monday, September 14th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinua Adofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, donors pledge more than $1 billion to Afghanistan.
Humanitarian aid will not solve the problem if the economy of Afghanistan collapses. And we know that the risk is enormous.
Plus, UN General Assembly opens in New York.
Well, I think it's going to be an interesting experiment because for the first time since COVID, there's going to be a large number of foreign leaders gathering at the United Nations in person.
Also, carbon capturing plant begins operation in Iceland. Our top story today involves North Korea. Top nuclear envoys from Japan, the United States, and South Korea held talks in Tokyo on Tuesday to discuss how to rein in North Korea's missile and nuclear programs a day after Pyongyang said it conducted a new long-range missile test. North Korea's state media announced on Monday what it said was successful test of a new long-range cruise missile that analysts said could be the country's first such weapon with nuclear capabilities. The three countries have been discussing ways to break a standoff with North Korea over its nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles programs, which have drawn international sanctions. In a meeting with his Japanese and South Korean counterparts, the U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea, Song Kim, said Washington remained open to diplomacy to deal with North Korea issues. Donors have pledged more than $1 billion to help Afghanistan, U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres said on Monday. Poverty and hunger have spiraled in the country since the Islamist Taliban took power and foreign aid has dried up, raising the specter of a mass exodus. Guterres said it was impossible to say how much of the money had been promised in response to an emergency UN appeal for $606 million to meet the most pressing needs of a country in crisis. After decades of war and suffering, Afghans are facing, quote, perhaps their most perilous hour, unquote, he said in his opening remarks to a donor conference in Geneva.
Today, we already heard clearly more than $1 billion of pledges. It is impossible, as I said, to say how much of this will be for the flash appeal, but in any case, it represents a quantum leap in relation to the financial commitment of the international community towards the Afghan people. Humanitarian aid will not solve the problem if the economy of Afghanistan collapses. And we know that the risk is enormous and that there is a dramatic lack of cash. We cannot even operate if the banks are not operating, even to pay the salaries to our staff. My appeal to the international community is to find ways to allow for an injection of cash in the Afghan economy, allowing the economy to breathe and avoiding a collapse that would have devastating consequences for the people of Afghanistan and possibly would trigger a massive exodus with the consequences that you can imagine in relation to the stability of the countries of the region.
That's U.S. Secretary General Antonio Guterres. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken defended the U.S. evacuation from Afghanistan for the first time before a congressional panel Monday. Lawmakers, Republicans as well as several Democrats, criticized the Biden administration's handling of the chaotic August withdrawal, which ended the longest war in U.S. history. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
2 weeks after the last U.S. flight left Kabul, ending the nearly 20-year U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan, U.S. lawmakers questioning Biden administration officials for the first time for failing to anticipate the Taliban's rapid takeover of the country and for sticking to an August 31st deadline for the U.S. withdrawal. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
There's no evidence that staying longer would have made the Afghan security forces or the Afghan government any more resilient or self-sustaining. If 20 years and hundreds of billions of dollars in support, equipment, and training did not suffice, why would another year, another five, another 10?
The administration has defended the chaotic and deadly evacuation that turned into the largest airlift in U.S. history. The U.S. and its allies evacuated 124,000 people, most of them Afghans, after the fall of Kabul on August 15. Republicans say the White House could have avoided those images of chaos, which damaged the United States' reputation internationally. Republican Representative Steve Chabot.
We went into Afghanistan in the first place because the Taliban had harbored Al-Qaeda, correct? And they attacked us on September 11th. Now, 20 years later, we have the Taliban back in charge there, and they have billions and billions of dollars worth of our equipment and our weaponry. And once again, they're a haven for terrorists. How is this not a debacle of monumental proportion?
Blinken telling lawmakers that while the U.S. effort in Afghanistan did neutralize the threat from al-Qaeda, there was a larger lesson to learn about U.S. involvement overseas.
While we are very effective at dealing with terrorist threats to our country and eliminating them, which we did very successfully in Afghanistan, the idea of using military force to try to remake a society is something that is beyond our means and beyond our capacity. And we need to think really hard about whether we want to engage in these enterprises going forward.
And while some Democratic lawmakers have criticized the way the White House handled the withdrawal, they argue Biden was put in an impossible situation by the deal negotiated by former President Donald Trump. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
The rapid fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban brings back the threat of global terrorist groups having a haven where they can regroup and thrive. The U.S. Congress has held hearings on how the U.S. and the West best can manage the risk of terrorism, which shows no sign of abating. Patrick Dunleavy, senior fellow at the Investigative Project on Terrorism, tells VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy a new approach is needed to combat international terrorism.
Well, one thing the United States has to do, and the West has to do, which is something that the Islamic terror groups have been able to do, is to change groups like ISIS, who grew out of Al-Qaeda and out of other groups, have over the years, this 20-year war, changed their tactics, changed the way that they communicate. So if the United States would want to, or the West would want to, have some sort of chance of having a victory in this, there has to be vigilance, there has to be innovation in tactics. And the one thing that has to be stopped is releasing terrorists. As we come to the 20th anniversary of 9/11, we have to remember that there was a World Trade Center bombing in 1993. Two of those individuals involved in that, an individual by the name of Ibrahim El-Gabrani and Victor Alvarez, have recently been released by the Bureau of Prisons and are now living in New York City. John Walker Lynn, also known as the American Taliban, who was responsible for the death of the first U.S. serviceman killed in Afghanistan, was released last year. The Taliban released thousands of prisoners from the Puli Chakri prison outside of Bagram Air Force Base, and many of those that they freed were al-Qaeda, ISIS Khorasan members. So we have to stop releasing terrorists, and we have to start moving with innovative techniques if we're to be successful.
But so far, the U.S. focus was on targeting terrorist leaders and groups without effectively addressing the ideology that motivates and animates followers and led to the spread of Salafi jihadism. As an expert on terrorism, what would be your prescription for a new, more balanced strategy and approach to deal with the war of ideas that has been outplayed by the terrorists?
Well, I think you've identified a key problem in the fight against radical Islamic terrorists that goes back to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan against the Russians and on through the years in 1993 in Tanzania and in the American embassies and all the other attacks that have taken place. We found that the governments can successfully combat physical threats, but they are not equipped to combat ideology. It is not the government's responsibility to change the religious views of people. That has to come from the community. That has to come, particularly if we're talking about something like radical Islamic ideology akin to Salafist, then that must come from the Muslim community at large and from communities and leaders within the country, both from religious and secular avenues, that confront this ideology, this false ideology that says killing innocent people somehow does service to God. So I think there has to be a combined effort by the government to combat the physical threats, but there has to be an effort by countries and their communities to combat the ideology successfully. It's not the government's role.
That's Patrick Dunleavy, senior fellow at Investigative Project on Terrorism, speaking with my colleague Mohammed El-Shenawi. The 76th session of the United Nations General Assembly begins in New York Tuesday. Delegates are expected to grapple with worsening human rights abuses in some countries, increasing climate change dangers, the coronavirus pandemic, and widespread hunger. Unlike last year's meeting, which was held virtually because of the coronavirus pandemic, leaders of more than 50 countries are expected to address the session in person. U.S. President Joe Biden is expected to attend. For more, I spoke with VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir.
Well, I think it's going to be an interesting experiment because for the first time since COVID, there's going to be a large number of foreign leaders gathering at the United Nations in person. So this will be a test. It could go off great or it could turn out to be a big super spreader event. The jury is still out on what's going to happen on that front. We were not expecting so many leaders to come in person. In fact, the United States mission to the United Nations sent a letter to all the delegations asking them to basically stay away and send video messages. But at last count, President Biden will be at the UN General Assembly on the first day to deliver his speech in person, and 82 other heads of state will be coming in person, and 43 prime ministers and heads of government will also be coming. So that's quite a large group for a UN General Assembly held during the pandemic still, especially when we know that not everybody is vaccinated, that only 20% of people in low and lower middle income countries have been vaccinated.
What is the realistic expectation?
Well, there's never a particular outcome expected. Like I said, it's mainly for leaders to come and meet and talk. It's an opportunity where the whole world gets together normally so that they have this one-on-one time to try and do face-to-face diplomacy to sort out pressing issues. So this year it will be a combination of face-to-face diplomacy and online virtual diplomacy. So maybe this is the new direction that we're going in, you know, permanently. We don't know yet, but in some ways it affords people from some countries a better opportunity to participate because they can participate virtually than it might have before. So it can have its benefits as well.
That's VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with me from New York. The UN Human Rights Council opened its annual session in Geneva. In an address Monday, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, warned that climate change and pollution pose grave threats to human rights and humanity itself. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN rights chief says human inaction in the face of planetary disasters is having a severe impact on a broad range of rights, including the rights to adequate food, water, education, health, and even life itself. Michelle Bachelet says extreme and murderous climate events have been unleashed on people in every region in recent months.
Monumental fires in Siberia and California. Huge sudden floods in China, Germany, and Turkey. Arctic heat waves leading to unprecedented methane emissions and the persistence of interminable droughts from Morocco and Senegal to Siberia, potentially forcing millions of people into misery, hunger, and displacement.
Bachelet warns intensifying environmental threats constitute the single greatest challenge to human rights. She says environmental disasters amplify conflicts, tensions, increase vulnerabilities, and structural inequalities around the world. For example, she notes the humanitarian emergency in Africa's Sahel countries is being fueled by climate change. She says long droughts followed by flash floods, unequal access to natural resources, and high rates of youth unemployment are plaguing the region.
These trends compel people to displacement, aggravate conflicts and political instability, and fuel recruitment by violent extremist groups. In such a situation, it should be clear that there can be no purely military solution to the conflicts in the region. To date, 4 million people across the Sahel have been displaced, according to UNHCR estimates.
Bachelet says similar trends and challenges exist in different forms and to varying degrees in all regions of the world. For example, Asia, the Middle East, and North Africa are gripped by water shortages, causing tensions to rise over this scarce resource. She reports climate change is having a striking impact on poverty, displacement and fundamental human rights in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. She says environmental and human rights defenders are being threatened, harassed, and even killed, often with complete impunity, in Latin America, Southeast Asia, and other regions. The UN Rights Chief says a safe, clean, healthy, and sustainable environment is the foundation of human life. She adds, the future of humanity depends on governments acting to preserve the world's precious resources. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America. The Kremlin says Russian President Vladimir Putin is going into self-isolation because of coronavirus cases among his inner circle. The announcement came Tuesday in the Kremlin's readout of Putin's phone call with Tajikistan's president. Putin has been fully vaccinated with the Russian coronavirus vaccine, Sputnik V. He received his second shot in April. The Russian president attended several public events on Monday, and officials said he has tested negative for coronavirus. Lawyers say a court in Myanmar has agreed to change the venue of the trial of an Australian economist and advisor to ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi on charges of violating the nation's official secrets law. Sean Tunnell was charged along with Aung San Suu Kyi and three other cabinet ministers under the law in March, a month after the military ousted the elected government and seized power. One of Aung San Suu Kyi's lawyers says the Supreme Court's decision removed the trial from Yangon, Myanmar's biggest city, where Tunnell was arrested, to the capital, Naypyidaw. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet warns the increasingly brutal conflict in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region threatens to spill over to the whole Horn of Africa. Preliminary findings of a joint investigation by the UN Human Rights Office and the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission into alleged violations in Tigray have been submitted to the UN Human Rights Council. We have Lisa Schlein again reporting from Geneva.
Since the last update in June, fighting has continued unabated in Tigray and has expanded into neighboring Afar and Amhara regions. Human Rights Chief Bachelet says mass detentions, killings, systematic looting, and sexual violence have displaced nearly 2 million people in this region and has created an atmosphere of fear. She says civilian suffering is widespread and impunity is pervasive. Bachelet says investigators have documented multiple allegations of human rights violations, including extrajudicial killings, torture, and enforced disappearances. She says sexual and gender-based violence, including gang rapes, have been characterized by a pattern of extreme brutality and ethnically targeted.
From my last update to the Council to date, allegations of human rights violations have continued to implicate government forces and its allies. We have received disturbing reports that local fishermen found dozens of bodies floating along the river crossing between Western Tigray and Sudan in July. Some allegedly had gunshot wounds and bound hands, indications that they might have been detained and tortured before being killed.
The Ethiopian government declared a unilateral ceasefire in Tigray at the end of June, nearly 8 months after it began its military offensive in the region. Shortly after, Tigrayan rebels retook the capital, Mekele. Bachelet reports Tigrayan forces have perpetrated many human rights abuses since gaining control of parts of Tigray and expanding to neighboring regions.
During the period under review, the Tigrayan forces have allegedly been responsible for attacks on civilians, including indiscriminate killings resulting in nearly 76,500 people displaced in Afar, and an estimated 200,000 in Amhara. More than 200 individuals have reportedly been killed in the most recent clashes in these regions, and 88 individuals, including children, have been injured.
Bachelet says accountability for human rights abuses and a national reconciliation process are the only solution to the conflict in Tigray and to achieving a sustainable peace. The chief of the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, Danielle Bekele, says all parties to the conflict have committed violence against civilians, including sexual violence and use of child soldiers. But he notes the situation in Tigray is complex. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Israel carried out airstrikes in the Gaza Strip on Monday in response to Palestinian rocket fire into its territory, the Israeli military said. Soraya Ali of Reuters reports.
Airstrikes rained down on Gaza on Monday. Israel carried out the attack in response to Palestinian rocket fire on its territory for a third consecutive night, according to the Israeli military. Fighting between the Palestinians and Israel has escalated over the past week after six Palestinian militants escaped from a maximum security prison in Israel on September 6th. Israeli forces have since captured four of the inmates. Gaza militants fired a rocket into Israel on Friday when two of the prisoners were apprehended, and then again on Saturday after two more inmates were caught. The Israeli army said rockets were intercepted by Israel's Iron Dome missile defense system. No casualties were reported. The Israeli military said it struck targets belonging to Hamas, the Islamist armed group that rules Gaza. The recent rise in cross-border violence tests a fragile truce between Gaza and Israel that ended fierce fighting in May.
That was Reuters' Soria Ali reporting. Researchers in Australia have developed new microscopic lasers that have a range of potential medical, industrial and military uses. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Researchers at the Australian National University say nano lasers promise to be even more powerful than conventional technology. The technology uses laser light instead of electronics and is an approach called photonics. Nano lasers, they say, need only a small amount of energy to start shining. Instead of using mirrors that reflect light, the team has created a device that traps energy and prevents it from escaping. That power is harnessed and builds into a strong, well-shaped beam. Researchers say this overcomes a well-known challenge of nano lasers, energy leakage. The project is a collaboration with academics at Korea University and is published in the journal Nature Communications. The lead researcher is Professor Yuri Kivshar, who says the beams would act like a torch or flashlight to guide a surgeon.
Why do we need smaller? Imagine you're doing kind of operation inside of body and you're using optical fiber. So optical fibers introduced inside of body will see only light, which inside is basically nothing. So you need kind of torch. This torch will lighten the place which you need to work on, and that will be kind of real torch effect.
Academics have said that while their nano lasers are not the smallest ever developed, they're among the most efficient and powerful. According to the ANU study, the energy threshold at which the laser starts to work is about 50 times lower than any previously documented nano laser. The physicists believe the technology could have a range of applications in small devices, including hair removal, laser printing, nighttime surveillance, and the illumination of delicate surgery inside the body. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Authorities in Greece opened an investigation on Tuesday into the crash of a private plane from Israel that killed a prosecution witness in the corruption trial of former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Pam Geron, a former senior official at Israel's Ministry of Communications, and his wife Esther were killed in a crash late Monday off the island of Samos. Geron was one of more than 300 witnesses that prosecutors listed for Netanyahu's trial on corruption charges. He is charged with illegally accepting expensive gifts from wealthy associates, allegations he denies. Greece's Air Accident Investigation and Aviation Board is investigating the cause of the crash. The Coast Guard recovered the body of the two Israeli occupants several hours after the plane went down in the ocean. Netanyahu, now the opposition leader in Israel's parliament, has denied all the accusations. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mark Will Yobaro, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05.